Winifred Sanford, Reel 5.
And then, like a torrential storm, burst from him. Hungry by day and bombed by night. Their babies lost in the wreck of their homes. Their sons and their husbands killed at the front. No fuel for winter, no fire for cooking. Fugitives tramping into the city, sitting for hours on the curbstones outside the social assistance office. Suffering, starvation and death. And they buy books. And they sing. They go to meetings and classes. They till the fields and invent machinery. They go to the hairdressers and they wear pleasing clothing. And they preach hygiene and cleanliness. And they listen to the radio and they buy newspapers. They know the foreign news before other nations get it. Did you ever see a people so avid for information? And they buy Bibles. Look at them. Look at their faces. They may be starving, but they're happy. These men and women are free pair, my friend. Listen to their songs. The old man put his head down on his arms and sobbed. I thought to myself, I must get one of those Bibles, but somehow I never did. My work took me out of Barcelona, and I used to say, I can get a Bible any time. How wrong I was. When Franco came into Barcelona, he burned 50,000 Bibles, proving to the people what a good Christian he was. It happened in France. The vines turned red and the days grew cooler as the autumn of 1938 came to starving Spain. The armies were pressed back to the Ebro, then over the Ebro. Dr. Juan Negrin, the president, announced at Geneva that all internationals would be withdrawn and asked that all foreigners be withdrawn from the fascist side too. Hitler laughed. That would mean the end of the war and a victory for Spain. The internationals were assembled, given an unforgettable farewell in Barcelona, and after some delay for arrangements, they were sent home. Spain faced the fight alone. I heard rumours that Chamberlain was rushing across Europe to shake hands with Hitler. It was time for me to go too. I took a Spanish comrade with me to the border, handed my car over to him for the Spanish people, and left the country that I had called mi segunda país. That winter I devoted to going to many of our largest ports and speaking at meetings to raise money that Britain might send food ships to Spain. After I had left Newcastle, the friends of Spain who had entertained me there received a parcel of Nazi literature from Hamburg, addressed to me. They did not forward it to me. Then the National Joint Committee for Help to Spain asked me to go to Perpignan, a town I already knew, for I had once lived in a village near there, in the south of France, to find out what was happening, for news came that the Spaniards were being driven out of their country into France. I posted my report to the House of Commons and then flew back, went straight to the committee sitting at the House, and arrived just as it had been read, and they were discussing how to act on it. I no longer have a copy of that report, but the following is written up from notes that I made at the time. I joined some Quaker women doctors and went with them down onto the beach where thousands of Spaniards were herded by the French fascists. So I learned from the people themselves what had happened and what was happening there. The fascist armies pressed northwards. Barcelona was full of refugees as town after town fell. The fascists bombed the big market off the Rambla de Flores just at the hour when it was full of women shopping, searching the counters for a little food. The Feast of Kings, that we call Christmas, came again. The Women's Anti-Fascist Committee closed its premises. The anarchists, the communists, the UGT, the CNT, the press offices, the youth offices, all closed up and prepared to move. "We cannot live under fascism. We will go to France. The French will take us in," said the people. Some, with friends in other countries, wrote to them and prepared to travel straight through to England or Holland or Sweden or America, wherever it might be. The government had the art treasures from the museums and cathedrals loaded onto 70 trucks and driven to Geneva for safety. But the army and the people walked. Once again the donkey carts came out on the road. Trucks carried a few children, but the majority walked. By January the 22nd, Franco marched into Barcelona. Those who had elected to stay remained behind closed doors and shuttered windows, and the city was silent. They were thinking of the day the internationals went, when they had run out with bunches of flowers, when the people thronged the balconies, and La Passionaria was there, and the nation sang. The hospitals throughout Catalonia were full. When the wounded heard the news, they got up and walked. Men with their legs in plaster casts, their arms in aeroplane splints, sick men, dying men, all got up and began to walk. "It is better to die on your feet than to live on your knees," La Passionaria had said, and they believed her. The Italian planes were circling overhead, bombing little towns, machine-gunning the road. "Muy bien, compañeros, let us die on our feet." Many of the foreign nurses had stayed with their patients, refusing to leave until the hospitals gave the order. Trucks and cars were abandoned as they ran out of petrol. They buttoned their coats against the keen January wind. Snow lay like a satin robe on the mountains of the Canigou. Families sat huddled together or tried to prepare food at the side of the road, among the rocks and the box bushes. They mounted higher and higher to the little town of La Pertuse, and there was the frontier. 500,000 Spaniards went through into France. First came women and children, some lugging suitcases and carrying blankets. Women with little children dragging at their skirts had walked 100 miles. Children had been bundled into trucks and had been told to get out 60 miles from the border and walk the rest for want of petrol. Then came the wounded, carried on stretchers by their comrades and limping with crutches and sticks. When an enterprising French photographer came to photograph them, they could still smile and raise a clenched fist. Lastly marched the army in orderly files covering the retreat. For days and days came the stragglers, people who'd made up their minds after the army had passed, and people who had stopped by the roadside to bury their dead. I'd often driven to the border to meet a new nurse or doctor from England. The men at the customs had been friendly and had even let me go over into France to get a meal. A French woman had told me about the time when she had seen French trucks rolling into Spain. "I remember the day," she said, "when 50 French trucks went through, laden with food and each bearing a legend, from the children of Paris to the children of Spain, from the citizens of Lyon, and so on. And the villagers at La Pertuse came out to watch the huge covered trucks with their little red sidelights, and we were proud of the people of France. They were going all night," she said. The French guards stood lined up in groups of 20, ready to spring alert at the command of their officers. The fascists stood on guard, too. Gone was the friendship that had once prevailed at the frontier. They went on to Saint-Cyprien. Bedraggled men in khaki were put behind barbed wire, their rifles taken from them. Others moved on to the wide sandy beach at Argelès. I left the hotel at Perpignan and went along the road past some villas to the beach. Bell tents of the French soldiers were pitched in the shade of thin pines. Crowds moved urgently as if bent on some business. French women pushed their way into their houses. Some Spanish women with children clinging to them were looking for the relief station the Quakers had set up outside the barbed wire fence. Moorish soldiers in their scarlet cloaks exercised their grey horses madly up and down the open spaces. Smart French guards jostled with the guards from the government buildings in Barcelona. The magnificent uniforms of the Spanish guards were now dusty and sad, boots worn and muddy, cloaks like dirty, ill-shapen blankets, still flying with uncrushable majesty. Cars and trucks honked, men shouted and called to each other. I saw a man lying on the pavement by a white wall. He was a soldier of the Spanish People's Army in full uniform. His head and shoulders were wrapped in a khaki cape. His boots were stiffly apart. I knew that he was dead. I had seen death amid the groans of the wounded. I had seen death in the stillness of a room. I had seen death in the chaos of bombed houses, and death by the wayside, mid a people in flight. At all these times there had been someone who looked on. But never had I seen death amid such turmoil, such inconsequence, such indifference. His rigid body seemed to be waiting to be removed with the same patience that the Spaniards in the concentration camps were waiting for the world to do something. Men and women walked past him, stepped round him with the same disregard that people in distant cities were showing to the story of a murdered republic. I went with the women doctors into the barren sandy yard of the Quaker Relief Center. Around the wall, women with lined and haggard faces sat with babies in their laps. Toddlers came up and gazed wonderingly into our faces. "Can you get us something to use against the lice?" one of the younger women said. We made notes of their most urgent needs and turned to leave. We wanted to tell them that the democratic countries were mobilizing help, that Britain and the United States would not let them perish. But we dared not raise their hopes. We went to a large gate where we established our credentials. We passed inside. On three sides of the open beach there was the barbed wire fence. On the fourth, the sea. Thousands and thousands of men. We were told that the women and children had already been removed into stables and old prisons in France. Crowds of men were standing at the fence, waiting for anything that French working folk could slip through to them before the guards roughly chased them away. Scores of others had broken through the fence to look for wood. Yonder, in a sparse stretch of woodland, or perhaps in the hope of escaping. But they were being pushed back by the French soldiers. We kept walking along the sand through groups of the older men till we came to the military camp where the Spanish army was held. A youth was sobbing because they'd taken his rifle from him, a rifle he had kept by him the whole of the war since he was a lad of 15 and had made a promise never to lose it. And he learnt to sing, "On your rifle depends your freedom." He told us about the rations handed out to them, a little bread, a little uncooked rice, and sometimes a little raw meat. They had to find a way of cooking it. Soon the sticks from the woodland would be all gone. The sand got into the food, and of course there was never enough for 250,000 of them. Some of the men had tried to make shelters from reeds found on the shore and blankets they had lugged all the way. Some had dug holes in the sand to crouch in out of the wind at night. Everyone we spoke to asked, "Are you going to get us out of this?" Some said they were willing to work anywhere. I saw men lining up at the barbed wire fence for water, to get a drink as a truck went by. A mobile dispensary van drove in, and men with old wounds waited to line up to have them dressed. We went to a hut where a number of doctors had met. They were making a survey of the whole camp, trying to find out the name of every man there. Most of them had been captains in the army. They wore long khaki overcoats that covered dirty shirts. Their boots were worn, their faces unshaven. They were not all Spanish. They were international doctors from fascist-dominated countries, from homelands they dared not return to. The doctors listed the medical supplies they needed. They had an old typewriter that someone had lugged from an office in one of the towns. The man in charge had been a judge in the High Court of Barcelona. They asked only for the most urgent needs of the men on the open sands. And one of them sighed, "Oh, I should like a comb." There were no toilet or sanitary facilities. They were using the part of the shore nearest the waves. There was no privacy at all. Against this lack of every human necessity, doctors were fighting diseases of the body, and men out there on the shore were fighting to keep up morale. At the border, everything had been taken away from them, their carts, animals, harness and saddles. Pickpockets had swarmed in from the big French cities and bereft them of their watches, jewellery and purses. We went back to the civilian section, picking our way between reclining, tired folk, men trying to make a fire on which to cook the meagre ration of rice. Near at hand was a dead mule, and men were trying to cut it up to make a supper for a few. A few nodded, "Salud, compañera." Others rolled themselves in dirty blankets to get out of the wind, rolled up against somebody's rough shelter, and went to sleep. Some for the last time. My life in Barcelona, 1936 to May 1937. When war was thrust upon Spain in July 1936, the country was divided by a number of political parties and various trade unions. The legal government knew that in order to defend the country from invasion, they must form a popular front and create an army. At the time of the outbreak, most of the rank and file of the army stood by the government, while that of the aristocracy and wealthy bourgeoisie supported Hitler and the traitor generals. I was there before July the 18th, 1936, but that is another story. From my fortunate position in Barcelona, I was able to watch the building of the Popular Front and the efforts of the Catalans to build a people's army. In order to understand the terms we used in everyday speech, I'll outline the names of the political parties. Esquerra Republicana. These were the left Republicans who had supported the government against the monarchy since the abdication of the king in 1931. The Communist Party. PSUC, P-S-U-C, the United Socialist Party of Catalonia and the Communists. This unity with the Socialists was one of our first efforts towards forming a popular front. FAI, F-A-I, the Iberian Anarchist Federation. PUM, P-O-U-M, Workers' Party of Marxist Unification. JSU, United Socialist Youth. The youth sections of all parties united in one organization. Trade Union Groups, UGT, General Union of Workers, a trade union federation with communist and socialist leadership. CNT, National Confederation of Labour, a trade union federation whose leadership was anarchist. FOUS, a Workers' Federation of Syndicalist Unity, a trade union organization started by the Trotskyists and encouraged by the fascists to split trade union unity, made illegal by the government in 1937. In the early days, it was our custom to go first thing to a cafe for coffee and a piece of bread and listen to the talk around us and get the morning papers as soon as the newsboys came along. Two stories stand out in my memory. The other night, the anarchists took 50 communist tram drivers out to the edge of the city and shot them. I did not doubt the story. Months later, I knew of a German volunteer who spent one day in the city while passing through, who reported that the anarchists were in control of Barcelona. It must have been incidents such as that that gave rise to such sweeping and untrue statements. One morning, we called to a paper boy who seemed exceptionally excited. We bought a paper and read, 30,000 Italians have landed on the south coast. A disturbed murmur went through the men around us. This is an invasion. This will last a long time. We'd been saying that it would be over in a few weeks. Franco's insurrection had failed in most of the big cities. At Valencia, the army had marched round the cathedral and refused to take part. In Barcelona, the people had swarmed to the barracks, got arms and defeated the rebellious fascists. Madrid held firm in support of the legally elected government. Toledo had defeated the rebels until the fascists hid behind a lot of women and children to prevent the people defending their city. Yes, we believed that Franco had failed, and so he had. We were confident that we could clear up the few places remaining in his hands, and now the confident Catalans were shocked. Mussolini had taken hundreds of young Italians and promised them farms in Abyssinia. When they got out to sea, they were given uniforms and told they were to fight in Spain against the Spanish people. So the work for the Popular Front was on. Ordinary civilians saw evidence of it in the streets. When the German writer Hans Beimler died, crowds came out to follow his coffin along the Ramblas. Flowers and banners were carried by different political parties. Simple folk asked, "What is it, comrade?" When the anarchist leader Durruti was killed, some said by his own followers because he'd begun treating with the communists about joining the Popular Front, the same happened. All parties turned out at his funeral, and flowers and banners followed the coffin. Again, it was the chance of those who understood to explain to the people the meaning of unity and to fight this war, which many of them, especially of the women, could not understand. For some weeks, when I had to stay up to do the midnight broadcast to America, I would sit in a cafe while waiting. I met there a number of anarchist journalists. Several of them spoke quite good English. These were not bearded men with bombs as represented in cartoons. They were educated, serious fellows who really thought they had an advanced political theory that would work. They expressed a high standard of morals and a true belief in the equality of opportunity and ultimate happiness of mankind. But they seemed to me to assume that all men were good and each individual should go his own way towards this goodness, which would ultimately pervade the earth. They knew they were good men, and no one should jolly well tell them how to behave. When the government organized demonstrations and processions through the streets, Psuk asked its followers to maintain orderly lines and to obey the few marshals there. Phi straggled along in a disorderly fashion, looking untidy in their persons and their ranks. To show how brave they would dash off to the front without any organization, without uniforms or weapons. They would also come back to Barcelona if they felt like it. In fact, they were a nuisance, and in time of war, a dangerous nuisance. Some of these demonstrations were organized to make the people aware of the need for a popular army, a people's army. There was much enthusiasm. Men and women drilled in the streets after work. A huge statue of a soldier was erected in the Plaza de Catalunya. Meetings were held in open places. Recruiting officers were busy. Car factories became aeroplane factories or munition works. By the beginning of 1937, Barcelona knew that this was not a civil war, but a war of invasion. One day I was standing in the plaza listening to a speech about the need to build an army. The man was a good speaker and people paused to listen. Suddenly, into the quiet of the meeting, there burst the noise of a brass band. A small, disorderly procession of youths and girls was marching into the square, headed by a few saxophones and drums. The girls wore blue blouses and red ties. The men carried flags, sprinkled with the insignia of the hammer and sickle. A large banner proclaimed them to be Poom. They caused a little disorder in the meeting, and men interested in listening to the speaker shouted, "Shh!" The youths marched off, singing loudly. "And the value of that," said a man nearby, "is to draw attention to themselves. No one believes they're any better than we are." A while later, some of us talked with one of the girls. "You belong to Poom?" "Yes," she replied proudly, "the Workers' Party. I joined last week." "Don't like your clobber," said one of the men, a Spaniard. "Stop it," she said. "I'm a free woman in a free country, and I'll dress as I like." He laughed. She'd caught him there. "But doesn't your friend at the factory belong to PSUK?" "Yes," she replied. "But she joined a long time ago, before they joined with the communists," as though she needed to make excuses for her friend. "Well, why can't your crowd see that unity is more use to the country than disaffiliation at this moment?" Her reply revealed where Trotskyite teaching was leading these youngsters. "A good revolutionary," she said, "will see that the workers rule everywhere. My party's not going to give in to the bourgeoisie. No concessions of any kind to the capitalists, we say. We're going to strive for the real thing. Not this compromise we got now. We don't want an army belonging to the nation like the socialists and republicans are advocating. We want every man to be a soldier himself and to fight the class that's against us." "Words, hollow words," said the Catalan comrade. "You'll see, she said, "we shall be able to do things as well as any other party. We shall be active." "Actively disrupted," one of us muttered. In December came a crisis in the Catalan government. Again we argued with these Poom youngsters. "It's all a wangle," said the girl. "They wanted to get Poom out of the government, so they engineered a crisis." "That is not true," we argued. "The change in the government was necessary because of the bad behaviour of Poom." "What behaviour?" "Poom is constantly attacking the Soviet Union, a country that had the decency to withdraw from that infamous non-intervention committee." "Then look at the extremism of your leaders," put in my Catalan friend. "They behave as though they were politically irresponsible." "We don't want men who force people to do things they don't understand. The days have gone by when every little union and party could lead its men to the front." So they went on pleading for the speeding up of industry and the distribution of food and the protection of peasants. Days went by. I was still working in the PSUK office, writing the bulletin for English-speaking nations and getting it out every 2 weeks or so. News came into us from the countryside. Yes, there were laws to protect peasants and to fix prices. We heard of villages where the country folk were being terrified by bands of incontrollables. In some villages, Poom had taken over the local councils, and the peasants were being told not to send their produce to the cities and to the front. Then we read in the papers about a new organization called FUS, which was recommending disunity in the trade unions. The government dissolved it and made it illegal, but the trouble with the incontrollables went on. Hume gave out that these gangs were anarchists, that the CNT disowned them. The leading anarchists repudiated them. It was plain to see that they were getting encouragement from Hume. In Barcelona, the city utilities, like the trams, electricity and so on, were owned by the anarchist organizations and the workers employed by the city. It was a fine field for opportunists. The city government was faced with the task of taking over the public utilities on behalf of the people. We read in La Battaglia, the Poom newspaper, to see how its leaders opposed that. And the young people bought the literature put out by the Trotskyists and stuffed themselves with all this tragic, erroneous thinking.